Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Suddenly, Congress and the presidential campaigns are all over the effect of speculation in the oil markets. Maybe half the price of oil is now the work of speculators, one hearing heard yesterday.
There's clearly a great deal of the price is coming from excessive speculation.
Obama and McCain have weighed in. New restraints are on the table. No one wants hedge fund billionaires skimming puffed up profits off the money we pay at the pump. But are they? This hour on Point, we look at speculators and the price of oil. Later in this hour, we'll talk with Congressman Bart Stupak, who chaired yesterday's hearings in the House. But first, joining me from Washington is Ian Talley of the Wall Street Journal, who covered yesterday's hearings of the House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations. Ian, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
So what was put on the table yesterday? What did the congressmen hear?
Well, I think, first of all, they over the last month or so, have been gathering data from the CFTC, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, the regulator of the energy futures market. And they say that 70% of the futures market in West Texas crude, the main crude contract, is traded by speculators and not refiners, airlines, truckers who need to buy that that commodity.
And that a huge change from just 6 or 8 years ago.
Correct, correct. They're using the same data that the CFTC has, but they included some participants in the market that the CFTC originally did not. So that's why it basically flipped the number around from about 30% is what the CFTC previously said to about 70% of the market, which is what Stupak's committee said.
Now, you quote the Commodity Futures Trading Commission sort of arguing with their use of the numbers yesterday, but let's say it's true. What did they hear that means? Does that mean price manipulation? Does it mean a puffed-up speculative bubble? Or even if that's true, aren't things still driven by the markets?
I think that what they're trying to say is that most of these people, if it is 70%, are not taking actual delivery of the crude. And when you have that amount of demand of people who are not actually taking delivery of the crude, then that drives up the price. Pure, simple abundance of demand.
They're not taking delivery because they're speculating about future prices, so it never really comes into their hands. It's about
Correct.
Where it's going to be.
That's right.
What did the folks before the committee yesterday have to say to that? Now, they picked them, so I suppose they had some sense in advance, but what was the testimony from those before the House panel yesterday?
Well, all of them agreed that there are certainly fundamentals driving oil prices. We have dwindling output from many of the larger producers, Russia, Venezuela, Iraq is not producing what they could. You have increased demand, particularly from Asia and China. But aside from those factors and the weakening dollar, they say that there is such an amount of speculation in the market that if you were to cut out that speculation, you would effectively drop prices by. Some said 30%, others say 50%. So that's really giving some in Congress the ammunition they need to pass much stricter regulation.
You had Mike Masters, a hedge fund manager, saying that you could see the cost of oil per barrel come down to something maybe nearer $65 or $70 a barrel. That is such a vast drop that would make such a difference in the economies and dynamics of so many countries right now. Is he way out on some edge of this debate, or is there a consensus that that's true, Ian?
Well, I certainly think that he has been certainly one of the leaders in this debate in Congress. There are many people who do believe that there could be that much speculative froth in the price. If you remember, it was only last October that we were trading closer to $70-$80 a barrel. And they argue, well, the actual fundamentals in the difference between supply and demand haven't changed that dramatically that prices would rise, you know, $50. So, you know, their argument does have some weight. Now, the CFTC argues, well, not all of those participants are actually speculators. A lot of the markets that they're calling speculator participants or they're calling speculators aren't really. They are airlines doing deals through a separate market. So I think the only way that we really will ever know is if Congress does act. Now, there could be some harmful side effects if Congress does that.
Well, put some of the proposals on the table. We'll hear the debate about what's going on, but what is Congress proposing? What might it do to try and dampen speculation, Ian?
Well, any trader has to put up collateral to trade, a cash collateral. That's called a margin. And
but not very much, maybe 5, 6, 7% in some of these oil trades.
Correct. But if you were trading stocks, it would be 50%.
Mm-hmm.
So many of the congressmen want to raise that to a much higher percentage. That's one option. I think that's the one that scares the CFTC and many of the in the market the most. They say that actually all of that trading would go to London, to Dubai, to Hong Kong, to other markets.
Are they saying by that it would not change the price of oil in the international markets, just move where the deals are done?
Correct. That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
It could drive. You do have some hedge funds that borrow a lot of money to trade, so that it would eliminate some of those speculators in the market. But they say that it would actually lower the prices very little, if at all.
What about this Enron loophole that Barack Obama and John McCain have both criticized? What's that?
That's basically allowing a lot of trading to go on what are called OTC markets, markets that are not regulated by the CFTC. And they're saying that because there's so much trading going on off unregulated markets, that is basically creating, allowing people to speculate more than they would if they were allowed to trade on the, say, New York Mercantile Exchange. So they want to bring all trading, wherever it is, under regulation and to have speculation limits.
And Ian, you cover the energy industry. When you must talk with lots and lots of people in this world. When you talk with them, what do they say? This is ridiculous. There's no way this will bring the price down. Or, yes, do this and down will come the price of oil.
I think many energy analysts who have been in the field for a while do say that most of this is a fundamental driver. There's a fundamental drivers, but what they often use is the sentiment. They use this phrase sentiment that there is a belief that there will not be enough supplies, and that is why the value of oil is that high. So rather than speculating, they're saying, well, because fundamentals, there's such a narrow gap between demand and supply and the amount of extra capacity that we have, that the value of oil should be at that price and to encourage new production to come online. I think that is the strongest argument that I've heard so far. Now, how much of froth, as George Soros said, is in the price, could be $5, $10. I think the EIA, the head of the government's Energy Information Agency, said there could be some top to that, but $50, $60, that would be some bubble, wouldn't it?
It sure would, but of course, as long as there's pain, there's going to be pushback. Ian Talley with the Wall Street Journal, thank you very much for being with us.
Great, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Joining us now from Silver Spring, Maryland, is Mark Cooper, Director of Research for the Consumer Federation of America. He testified last week before the Senate on energy speculation, arguing for more regulation in the commodities markets to bring down prices. Mark Cooper, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So is the public being ripped off, or is this the markets at work trying to tell us, you know, oil is dwindling and it's valuable and, you know, you need to pay a lot for it to acknowledge the facts of life?
Well, oil didn't dwindle enough in the last year to double in price. Let's be clear. In the last two or three years, the quantity of trading has doubled, the value has quadrupled, and yet use has increased by 2%. So the supposition that a sentiment is now that sometime in the future oil is going to be very scarce is costing a tremendous amount in the present. And frankly, $140 a barrel doesn't get people looking for it any faster than 60 or 70 would. It only costs $50, the oil executives tell us, to find it. And so, and OPEC takes a chunk of it because they restrict supply. But I think there's, we use the figure of $40 a barrel as a speculative bubble. And the important thing is, let's remember, this is not like gold, which has very few uses. This is a commodity we consume in huge numbers. So if we run the price up too much in the present, sort of anticipating some distant future, the consumer is paying that price today. It's not like it's the traders bear the burden. It's the consumer who bears the burden.
Mm.
By my numbers, using $30 a barrel over the last 2 years, that's $1,500 per household or $500 billion in the economy. So if the market gets it wrong by $30 a barrel for 2 years, it imposes a humongous cost on the public and the economy.
We're going to come back and look at how that works. But you know, even on the progressive side of the ledger, Paul Krugman, New York Times, writing, the nonsense in this debate, that is what he calls the mysticism over speculation. He says, the nonsense in this debate makes me want to shoot someone in the face. He's talking like Dick Cheney there. He's not buying it.
Well, the simple fact of the matter is that there's no doubt that fundamentals contribute. And we think the run up to $40 or $50 a barrel from what was $20 in 1999, $15 or $20, is part of the fundamentals. That's clearly, there's a fundamental problem here. OPEC is a problem here, but there's clearly, in these markets, a simple problem. Too much money is chasing too few goods in the commodity markets, and the money is going into these markets because we've invited it to go into these markets.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about speculators and the price of oil, asking if supply and demand explain the whole picture of the incredible oil run-up. Congress and Obama and McCain all asking variations of the same question. Let's listen for just a moment to some of the testimony from yesterday. Here's Fadel Gate, an oil analyst with Oppenheimer & Company, says artificial inflation in the price of oil, he sees it there. Yesterday he said that oil speculation may have doubled the price of a barrel.
So it should be around between $45 and $60. So, you know, meeting with the head of most of the oil companies that we cover, only a year ago, they were amazed at the sustainability of $60
oil. $60
oil
sounds like a super bargain today. Here's Texas Republican Joe Barton. He was with us last week, yesterday expressing skepticism about speculation's effect on the price of oil, said demand is outstripping supply and driving up prices.
Let me say at the very beginning that speculators are not the cause of high energy prices. We have high energy prices because there's less than a 1 or 2% margin of supply over demand in world markets today.
We've been joined by Mark Cooper, Director of Research at the Consumer Federation of America, and right now from San Diego by James Hamilton, Professor of Economics, University of California, San Diego. He's looked closely at whether speculation is behind high energy prices. Professor Hamilton, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me, Tom.
So we've heard people testifying yesterday, pro and con on this. You heard Mark Cooper saying he suspects there's a big chunk of this price that has to do with speculation, but then there's the supply and demand situation. Congressman Barton says, look, there's just not the supply. Of course it's driving prices up. How do you see what's going on?
Well, I think speculation may be making a modest contribution, but some of the people you've been quoting are really overdoing it. Here's the basic problem, Tom. If oil were selling right now for $60 a barrel, America would be consuming significantly more this year than we did last year.
Yeah.
Now, where is that oil supposed to come from? The fact of the matter is the Chinese just by themselves are consuming an extra 500,000 barrels a day each year. Their demand goes up by 500,000 barrels a day,
mm-hmm.
and global production has stagnated. Well, if they're consuming more and there's not any more being produced, that means less for us. So these people talking about $60 a barrel, I think they have to also tell you who's going to produce that oil.
Okay. Is it possible that that demand and supply ratios would drive the price way above 60 but not necessarily to 138, 140, not necessarily to the 200 that's being projected now. Could there be, you know, a giant speculative kind of skim in here of $20 a barrel or $30 a barrel, Professor Hamilton?
Yeah, I don't have a number for that. I am open to the suggestion there's some contribution. But basically, these price increases have reduced American demand, and that's pretty dramatic. But you don't see inventories piling up. We're consuming less, but there's no oil piling up anywhere. And so that's the basic issue that Krugman and others have with this hypothesis. You just don't see it showing up in inventories. There's a physical demand for this commodity, a physical supply, and I don't see a fundamental imbalance there at these prices.
Mark Cooper, how about it? Demand is growing, supply is not, and so it doesn't make sense to say that there's a big buffer of speculation in there.
Well, the margin of supply over demand was 1 or 2% 2 or 3 years ago. That Mr. Barton points to is a million barrels a day or 2 million barrels a day. The world has added a significant quantity of ethanol, over a million barrels a day. So supply is coming online globally, but the fundamentals have not changed to equal $60 a barrel. And Mr. Masters, who was mentioned in the lead into this study, mm-hmm. has calculated that the increase in the long positions, that is, the people who are holding the contracts with index investors, is equal to the total growth in Chinese demand over the past 4 or 5 years.
Index investors, you're saying people who are putting huge money into commodities, including oil.
And they stay in the commodity.
Yeah.
They're not your classical speculators who are sometimes holding buy contracts and sometimes holding sell contracts. These are people who use a formula to buy a mix of commodities and just pump more and more money in.
But what is wrong with that? Maybe they're looking out on the horizon. They're seeing supply constraints. They're seeing rising demand from many countries and saying, this is where our investment ought to go. Isn't that how the market works? Isn't that how we get the serious signal of supply problems?
In fact, commodities were not investment vehicles in the past. Commodity markets were intended primarily to smooth the operation of the physical market,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to be seen as an asset class to be invested in. The problem comes is when these people hold these huge quantities of contracts and constantly roll them over, it's another source of artificial demand, too much money chasing the same sort of physical commodities. So this tremendous increase in the number of contracts sold, the volume of contracts sold, adds to the upward pressure on prices, since there's more money trying to stay long, trying to hold the commodity and hold commitments to the commodity. It makes it harder and harder to get people to part with their oil. So if the markets, if we go back to what commodity markets used to do, simply provide a function for balancing supply and demand over a farming season over a short term.
Okay.
All of those and these investors would not be in this market holding commitments in the longer term to increasing demand. So we've artificially increased demand in the financial markets by having this tremendous influx of money, and that puts upward pressure on the price. It's too much money chasing too few goods, and we've invited them there. That's the important point, is that by having low margin requirements, we allow people to buy oil with a nickel on the dollar, as opposed to a stock which requires mm-hmm. 50 cents on the dollar. So we've made it too easy to play in these markets. If we made it harder, the money would go away, but that would solve the problem since we've got excess liquidity.
Okay, let's look at that. Professor Hamilton, how about it? Is it possible that you get, you know, Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase and Morgan Stanley Citigroup, they all pile in, pour a ton of money in here with just a nickel on the dollar, 5% down, and, you know, that plus the supply constraints, they watch it go up like crazy, and you know, they're delighted. Pension funds make out all right, but the guy at the pump and the U.S. economy and others pay the price. Is that possible?
The main thing you're leaving out there is that we're talking not about purchases of physical oil.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about purchases of financial futures contracts. They're two different things.
Yep.
And you can't just take dollars on one market and equate them to dollars on the other, or barrels of oil in one and barrels of oil on the other. The physical commodity is a flow that's measured in so many barrels of oil per day. The financial contract is a stock. It's a certain number of commitments at a point in time, and none of those entities you're talking about are physically accumulating the product of oil itself.
So no intersection, no impact one on the other?
Well, there is an intersection in that there's an arbitrage between those futures prices and the spot prices. But the point I've been emphasizing is there is a fundamental physical market here at the end of it all. There's a physical demand for oil, and that has nothing at all to do with anything done by Goldman Sachs or anybody else. There's a physical quantity of oil that people want to use. There's a physical quantity supplied, and that's the real number you have to look at here.
We'll come back and look at what constraints on speculation markets might mean for this whole formula, but let's take a call first from Indian Lake, New York. Daniel, you're on the air.
Thank you. Really enjoy your program. I always listen every day.
Thank you.
One of your speakers had a really good point as far as the speculation goes. I believe that the deregulation in Reagan was a good thing at that time. It's gotten out of hand. The house market shows it. The economy today shows it. And I believe a moratorium on speculation for three to six months would put the show the pudding in the pie or bring out the truth. And I believe that the markets have just need more regulation. It would help so many different ways.
Daniel, let us look at exactly that. James Hamilton, how about it? Daniel says, okay, let's test it. I mean, we saw what happened in the housing market when the finance community went off and did its thing with subprime and all the rest. We saw Enron, and we know California got kind of wrapped around its axle on energy prices not so many years ago. What would the consequences be if we just tested this by going in, put some kind of severe constraint on, you know, up require, I don't know, 50 cents on the dollar to play in the margins game in the futures, or somehow tighten up these speculative markets? Would that tell us something, Professor?
Well, there are a number of proposals on the table, and some of them make more sense to me than others. I personally would favor restrictions on the extent to which public employee pension funds, for example, or insurance funds could be exposed to risk in commodity markets. I think that might make sense from a public policy point of view of reducing the risk. As for the issue of margin requirements, I think there is a concern with some of these over-the-counter derivatives that, again, there's some systemic risk that's being created by that that's not in the public interest. But as for increasing the margin requirements on NYMEX, for example, don't forget there are two parties on each of these futures transactions we're talking about. There's a buyer and there's a seller. You can make it harder for the buyer, but you're also going to make it harder for the seller. In fact, it's the seller of futures contracts that may worry the most about meeting those futures requirements. And people who are arguing that there's an impact of this volume of futures buying, I think, are appealing to the idea that there isn't enough liquidity in this market. There aren't enough people willing to take that risk to expose them to sell oil futures, not knowing where the price is going to go. So that particular idea could potentially backfire.
Mark Cooper, do you fear, and some have said, if you start mucking around with this, you're messing around with markets and you're going to gum up the works and we'll end up with even higher prices. Are you concerned that could be the case?
In fact, for 75 years before we deregulated with the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, the markets worked just fine. It's the deregulation creation of instruments that really have nothing to do with the functioning of the physical market that has added to the problem. And the professor pointed out that at root this is a physical market. And so the speculation that's added on top of it is supposed to be there to serve the physical market.
Mm-hmm.
What we have now is we've driven the farmers out of the commodity market. The airlines are pulling their hair because they simply cannot meet the margin requirements as the price and volatility escalates. So, in fact, I'm not for banning speculation, but we have to put some limits on it. We have to go back to the days when the primary players in the markets were the commercials, the physical players. So that we should have a limit so that the speculators can't get up to 70% as has happened. Some people think it's even higher because we've misclassified banks who are not physical traders, who are not commercial traders. Mm. The CFTC calls them commercials when they're clearly speculators. So from our point of view, if you raise the margin requirements, you will scare some money out of the market. We think there's excess liquidity in this market. The volume has amped up dramatically in the last few years. So I'm not afraid of chasing some money out of this market because then the physical players will be able to get back into it and use it for the purpose for which it was intended.
The physical players, those who actually take possession of the oil. Let's get a call from Des Moines, Iowa, and Earl. Hi, Earl, you're on the air.
How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My biggest disappointment with this whole discussion about the price of oil, all your guests are, I think, accurately stating the underlying fundamentals. But the problem is that the politicians aren't talking about those things that we can control, and that is the cost, the value of the dollar. We can't control what traders do. We can't control what suppliers and users of oil do. We can influence them, yes, but we can't control it. The only thing we can control is the value of the dollar. If you look at all commodity prices, gold, silver, any commodity, the prices have gone up significantly as the value of our dollar has dropped. If the Fed would control the value of the dollar, you'd see the price of oil and all other commodities come down to where the markets would act on them as they normally
do. Right. Of course, that's not dead easy to control either when you've got the kind of debt and trade situation that we've got. But let us look at that, Earl, and thanks for your call. James Hamilton, what about the value, the price of the dollar in this whole equation as a factor?
Well, I think the caller is right. That certainly made a contribution, and I think we do have a policy that would address that. As the U.S. has reduced interest rates relative to Europe, that's put a lot of pressure on the dollar, and it has encouraged some of these long positions in commodities. So if the Federal Reserve were to raise interest rates back up, that might provide some relief on this issue.
Maybe, but lots of maybes in making that all work. Let's get a call from Boston. We've got Robert on the line. Robert Kaufman, I see here. Robert Kaufman, thanks for calling in. What do you know, sir?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call, and I'm saying hello to James Hamilton. We've done some stuff together in the Wall Street Journal.
You're an oil analyst yourself, Robert.
Right. Yeah, the comment I wanted to make is we've developed a model with the European Central Bank that forecasts oil prices ahead of time. And up until the fourth quarter of 2007, the model was doing very well. Indeed, it was doing as well as the futures market in anticipating what was going to happen to oil prices.
Mm-hmm.
But starting in that fourth quarter, oil prices have now moved well beyond what our model forecasts, and we think that is what represents the speculative component, which we estimate to be between $30 and $40 a barrel.
That's a lot. How do you think that would work? James Hamilton says, look, they're not taking physical possession. It comes down to the spot price on the barrel head. $30, $40 a barrel is a lot. How do you think that would get in there?
Well, as James knows, in the short run, it's really hard to either reduce demand significantly or increase supply significantly. So even if there is this speculative component, it's really not going to affect the fundamental rates of supply and demand much. And so you can build in the short run, this speculative component. And I just wanted to go back to a comment about the dollar that somebody made previously. And all our analyses indicate that it's not the value of the dollar affecting the price of oil, but rather it's the other way, that oil prices affect the dollar. And there's really relatively little evidence to indicate that if you push on the dollar, you'll affect oil prices, but rather if you push on oil prices, that's what will drive the dollar.
James Hamilton, how about it? Here's your colleague occasionally saying, well, their model doesn't make sense anymore, and they believe it's speculation, maybe $30 or $40 per barrel.
Well, again, I think you are actually seeing some of those responses in quantity demand in the U.S., and you're not seeing the accumulation of inventories. So I'm still asking, if oil were selling for $100 a barrel and U.S. consumers were using more, where would that extra oil come from, according to this model or these calculations?
Robert?
The change in demand you're seeing is very, very small, both in the U.S. and globally. And so what I'm trying to argue is that speculative component really isn't, in the short run, affecting the supply-demand balance. So the argument is the supply-demand balance wouldn't really be terribly different at $100 as opposed to $150 in the relatively short period in which we're seeing this kind of model failure.
And we're seeing it spike up like crazy. Thanks for your call, Robert. James Hamilton, Mark Cooper, please stand by. We're talking about speculators and the price of oil. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about speculators and the price of oil. Big topic of conversation this week in Congress. Barack Obama, John McCain both have been talking about it. But what's really going on here? James Hamilton has joined us, professor of economics at the University of California, San Diego. And from Silver Spring, Maryland, Mark Cooper is here from the Consumer Federation of America. He testified last week before the Senate on energy speculation. Michael's calling from Beaufort, North Carolina. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi. A comment was made a bit ago that there's the futures, the two markets, the futures and the real market, and that there's we shouldn't put too much blame on the futures for the real price. I would remind the guest, and I just looked this up, in 79, the Hunt family basically accumulated future contracts on silver that drove silver prices from 11 an ounce to 50 in a very short time. And when they were basically, when it was, they were found out and warned off it,
mm-hmm.
in 2 months of their stopping playing around with it, the price fell back from 50 to 11 in 2 months. And I think it's ridiculous to say that, that one doesn't affect the other. The other point I wanted to make was, isn't it interesting that with the housing bubble now about over, those instruments not allowing players with huge monies the room to make bets on that market,
yep.
that all of a sudden, within about the same time frame, this huge speculation rises in another major market. So I would suggest that the first thing to be done is it's ridiculous that we can't figure out for weeks and months who is making the bets. And the very first step, regardless of what else you do, is total visibility as to who. It should be a daily availability. It's ridiculous that the government doesn't have the right people, if they need to, don't have a way to determine who is making the bets on these commodities.
Let's have some transparency here, you say. There's a couple things on the table there, Michael, and thanks for that, James Hamilton. First to you, what about the lesson of the Hunts when they moved on silver way back in the 70s? Can we learn? And it did drive the price up. Is oil different from silver? What can we learn or not learn from that that bit of history?
Well, the caller is absolutely correct. It would be ridiculous to say there's no relation between the spot price and the futures price. Of course there's a relation. The specific point we were talking about mm-hmm. there was this claim by Michael Masters that you can take the volume of futures contracts outstanding as a number of barrels of oil and equate that with a volume per unit time of the physical oil that's purchased and just add one to the other and say the futures is part of the demand.
Mm-hmm.
That's a calculation that just doesn't make any economic sense. You can't even write down the equation because the units are different for the two things. That was the specific point I was addressing,
mm-hmm.
not claiming that futures prices are unrelated to spot. Of course they're related. There's arbitrage that makes them move hand in hand all the time. But because there is that spot market and there is a physical demand and a physical supply, we have to focus on that for any of this discussion, and that's what people seem to be leaving out.
What about your occasional colleague Robert Kaufman, who calls in and says, you know, in the short term, this can be played because demand may change, but this is oil. This is fundamental energy. That demand can't change that quickly. Supply can't change that quickly. So there's room, you know, in the gap for a lot of money to be made by investors, call them speculators, if you like.
Well, he's right about that, and that's why I'm sympathetic to the possibility that this can make some contribution, at least for a while. But we are really seeing pretty significant quantity adjustments now. And again, I come back to this growth from China. If their growth were to continue at the current pace, by 2020, they'd be consuming 20 million barrels a day, which is as much as the U.S. There's just no way that the world is going to be able to supply that quantity. And you have to have a story mm-hmm. for those physical quantities supplied and demanded to carry on any of this analysis that people are suggesting.
And maybe these high prices are giving us just that message. We're joined from Washington right now by a congressman who's been right in the thick of this. Michigan Congressman Bart Stupak joins us. He represents the 1st District of Michigan, way up there in northern Michigan. He's a member of the House Energy and Commerce Committee and chairman of the Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigation, which held hearings yesterday on energy speculation. Congressman Stupak, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
So, Congressman, maybe these high prices are delivering just the message you heard our economist James Hamilton describing. The demand is on a curve to far outstrip supply, and so, of course, oil prices are going to go way up high. You don't need speculators. It's the market telling us something important here, maybe.
Well, the only argument I would make is, especially in the United States,
the demand has actually been going down and has been going down little by little in the last 5 years, and in the last this year alone, it's gone down well over a percent or two.
Does that matter if China's demand is booming, sir?
Well, China's demand has been met, in fact, and there's still surplus. I mean, if China was taking all the extra oil, we would not have the surplus here in the United States. And even when we looked at the refined product, when the Energy Information Agency looked at the refined product for the first 90 days of this year, we had record volume of gasoline and diesel. And so here in the United States, it should not have that much impact. And what I'm talking about with speculators are actually contracts, which require for physical delivery here in the United States or are traded on computer terminals here in the United States. So I'm looking at what we're talking about here in the United States. While it does reflect a global market, I agree, but there's the supply is there. The supply is there.
You have said, Congressman, we risk having our economy brought to its knees by excessive speculation. What do you call excessive?
Well, the average speculation, you will, on a barrel of oil has always been there because of the hedging that we do, like the airlines industry do. That's always been there. It's always been $8 to $9 a barrel. And that's about where it should be. But now you're up talking, the experts were telling us yesterday, now we're talking upwards of $65 to $70 a barrel. Now that's more than excessive speculation. That's just gouging the American people.
What would you do about it?
Well, we'd close all these exceptions that the Commodities Future Trading Commission has given. We'd do these foreign boards. We'd close those foreign boards.
When you say foreign boards, not everybody will follow. I'm not even sure I do. What does that mean?
I'm sorry. Half the oil futures are traded on a market called ICE, Intercontinental Exchange.
Mm-hmm.
It closes in London. That's the only tie to being a foreign board that may close in, well, it doesn't even close in London anymore. They've now moved the main terminals and all that to Atlanta and Chicago.
Okay.
They place the orders here in the United States. It does a round trip to London periodically, but it's basically 64% of all the oil traded is for delivery or through computer terminals here in the United States. So it's really a U.S. exchange.
But are you saying you would close down some foreign markets?
No,
for
what I would say is bring transparency to it. See, the Commodities Future Trade Commission says if you're a foreign board, we won't look at your trading. We won't look at what you're doing.
I see.
Therefore, they can hide in the dark and how they're running up the price for these oil contracts. When oil jumps $11 in one day because the Israeli Minister of Transportation says, you know, it's inevitable we're going to have a war with Iran, suddenly we jump $11 in one day. That is insane. But
Why? Let's just take that. Why is that insane? If there were war with Iran, if Israel bombs it, and let's say Iran then closes the Straits of Hormuz,
yes.
Doesn't that logically, where so much of the world's oil travels, doesn't that logically put the price of oil over the moon again?
Well, shouldn't we at least wait for it to occur? I can say we'll have war with China next week. So therefore, should we drive up oil to $300 a barrel?
But that's the way markets work. If we knew, for example, that war with China or Iran was coming, I mean, that markets are all about the future.
But what is that market doing? It's playing off your fears. Complete speculation, fear, and leads to greed. I mean, when you have like Goldman Sachs, the largest dealer, 78% of the energy derivatives are on the Goldman Sachs exchange there. And when they sit there and they say, well, we expect oil to be 150. In fact, by the end of the year, it'll go to 200. The people who are making money off the speculations are the one driving the fear factor or putting these issues out there like, this is what it's going to be. Pretty soon, perception becomes reality as long as we're leaving the trading to those folks.
So,
and there's no oversight of those trades.
Congressman, are you saying then it's not just speculation but a kind of active manipulation? It sounds like that's the charge you're making there.
Well, I believe it is active manipulation. I really do. And when you take a look at it and you see a 425% increase in the number of futures contracts for oil in just the last few years, or the last 5 years, that's tremendous. Back when oil, and remember, oil is considered a commodity. Okay, so in other words, it's for people who produce it and people who consume it. That's what the market always been. Now we find 71% of the people, at least in April of 2008, are really speculators. They're not the producers. They're not the refiners. They're not the airline industries. They have no control. They can't hedge this price anymore because they've lost control of this market by speculators. And speculators are running up the price that is unconscionable, and it is going to bring our economy to the knees, to our knees. I have no problem with the oil companies and other people making a few bucks. We do need some liquidity in the market. We do need speculation at $8 or $9 a barrel. We can live with that. But when you're at 65 to 70, now that's a gross injustice to the American people, and they're gouging us every day at the pump.
Do you think Congress will pass the kind of restraints that that you're talking about, that you're proposing here? Will Congress actually act on this?
Sure. I actually have a bill called the Pump Act, H.R. 6330, which actually rolls back the clock to where we were in 1999. And since 1999, because of an Enron loophole through the Commodities Modernization Act that Congress passed in a big omnibus bill, they've been able to take advantage of a number of loopholes and exceptions. And all we're saying is, look, this industry should play by all the rules. Let's bring transparency. Let's close all these exceptions. If you want to be a hedge fund and you have a legitimate business need like an airline industry, then you should be hedging your risk as the future oil prices. But you shouldn't be in there with pension funds where you have no business interest in calling it a bona fide hedging exception.
Do you think this will pass? And if it does, where do you think the price of oil would go?
I think if we would pass H.R. 6330, the experts testified yesterday, we could drop oil prices in 30 days and we'd cut those prices between 40 to 50% decrease.
So down to, you're talking all the way back down to, I don't know.
$65 to $70 a barrel. 60. And even that's too high, they say, but that's where it would be. That's how much is just speculation.
Down to 65 or 70, maybe. Congressman Stupak, let me just put it to our economist for a moment, if I may. James Hamilton, can you imagine that happening? And are there risks involved if Congress moves and tries?
Well, I have to say, as an academic, I love the idea. It sounds like a wonderful experiment. Let's try it and see if it goes down $60. I don't for a minute believe that would happen. Some of the proposals I'm totally comfortable with. The idea of more transparency, the idea of regulating some of the over-the-counter derivatives, that makes a lot of sense. But if the price did go down to $65, you'd have a lot more demand in the U.S., and I hope the congressman also has a plan for where that oil is physically going to come from for those people that are going to want it.
Congressman, what about that? I mean, would that just put all the SUVs back on the streets and we go back to the old ways? And who would supply all that oil?
Well, I don't think we necessarily go back to the old ways. I think this $4 has been the tipping point. You saw yesterday where United announced they're laying off 950 pilots, and therefore planes are going to be grounded. I think the oil has have our attention. Whenever we talk about energy policy in this country, we're just not talking about trying to go back to days of cheap oil. We have to look at alternative energy sources, and different things each American can do. But the thing that bothers me and bothers the American people, as I said earlier, you don't mind paying for a product, but you sure darn hate paying for a product where you know you're not paying a fair price, and you know that someone is taking advantage, manipulating the market in this case, to for excessive profits. That's where the American people say enough is enough.
Congressman Bart Stupak of Michigan's 1st District, thanks very much for being with us, Congressman.
Thank you, Tom.
Let's get a call from Hamden, Connecticut. Angelo, you're on the air.
Hello. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Look, I just wanted to point out that this is really an international problem,
mm-hmm.
that there should be an international agreement to tax gasoline to discourage consumption. We have a problem when countries like China are effectively subsidizing gasoline, making it cheaper and encouraging consumers to use more. Also, we need to encourage automobile companies to produce cars that get better gas mileage. If Americans were driving cars that got 40, 50 miles to the gallon, we would significantly cut consumption of gasoline, which would drive down the price.
If American gas prices go back down, if let's say they go back down to $3 or $2.50 a gallon, do you think the Americans will continue to move toward conservation, Angela?
No, the prices have to be kept at around $3. We have to raise taxes on gasoline. We have no choice. Cheap gasoline got us into this problem to begin with.
Angelo, thanks for your call. Mark Cooper, maybe the speculators, if they have some impact on the price, maybe they're doing the country a favor as much as it hurts. Maybe they're moving us off the dime on breaking that what President Bush calls addiction to oil.
There are a lot cheaper ways to advance our policy than to allow us to be ripped off by a cartel. Let's be clear, this is not a market. It's a managed supply. The OPEC cartel has affected the price of oil by withholding investments in production. So there are other ways to do this. So we have fuel economy standards. They worked in the past. they could work in the future. We require manufacturers to produce and sell more fuel-efficient cars. If the consumer is confronted with a set of cars that has higher fuel economy, they will make their choices from the cars available. We don't have to allow ourselves to let the speculators take a dollar a gallon, impose essentially a tax on the consumer, and put it in their pockets.
Do you think Congress is going to act on this, or, you know, with the advice of economists and the counterweight of interests, or are they just going to talk and then move on?
Oh, no, I believe that maybe not this Congress, but certainly the next Congress will, in fact, close the loopholes that were a disastrous mistake. Congressman Stupak mentioned them. They will close the loopholes. They will force the Commodities Futures Trading Commission to define people correctly. Let's be clear. The CFTC has purposely misled the Congress and policymakers by misdefining who's buying the oil and who's selling it. We have pierced that bubble. By the end of 2009, there will definitely be a significant reform that increases transparency, imposes some more discipline, and squeezes out. This short-run bubble costs the economy $20 billion a month. We could take that $20 billion and put it into R&D, support automakers to build more fuel-efficient cars, be a much better use of that $20 billion tax than simply sending it off to speculate.
We could, maybe. Of course, we haven't. But Mark Cooper at the Consumer Federation of America, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
James Hamilton, thanks for putting your perspective out there one piece at a time. You can hear the skepticism as the pain of the pump hits people, but we're grateful for your insights. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.